Hey everybody, Mike Garrigan here. Last week, I released a new EP called Scenes, Volume 1. You can hear it at mikegarrigan.com and at my Bandcamp page. The four songs have been previously featured on this podcast. Also, if you become a member of the fan community, you can get a free download of the new EP, as well as a host of exclusive live shows and demo collections. Let's have a show.
This is the Mike Garrigan Podcast.
Welcome to episode 10 of 24 in the Transitions podcast series from MikeGarrigan.com. My name is Mike Garrigan. Thank you for listening to the last episode. A Eulogy for Lord Smithfield has been the best reviewed and most played episode in the past 2 years of my biweekly podcasts. Hearing about other people's experiences with losing a pet after sharing my own has been very helpful, and I guess you could say transformative. I feel different now, so thank you. The predominant question, though, that has kind of consumed me since the posting of the last show is, exactly where did Smitty go when he died? The Rainbow Bridge story offers a comforting idea. Although the author is unknown, it's hard to say whether or not that prose of what has become the basic Rainbow Bridge story is in the public domain. So being so, rather than recite it, I'm going to summarize it in my own words and give rightful attribution to Anonymous. The allegory of the Rainbow Bridge states that when your pet dies, it is restored to health and waits for you just outside the gates of heaven. And there he plays and has plenty of food and water, and he's happy. And when you finally arrive, he runs to greet you, and you both cross the bridge together. And that's quite a nice and comforting idea. The papal view from the Roman Catholic Church is varied, and I mentioned this first because I grew up Catholic, and that's where my roots are. In 1990, Pope John Paul II said definitively that animals have souls. In 2008, the idea was rescinded by Pope Benedict XVI, and in recent days, many have taken Pope Francis's comments that paradise is open to all of God's creatures as a statement that dogs, in fact, go to heaven, although there has been some backtracking and retreading and re-explaining of the statement, so it seems a bit inconclusive. Both conservative Catholic theology and conservative evangelical Christians denounce the idea that animals have souls. Conservative Catholicism looks at the issue from a semantic position, stating that because dogs have no souls, they can't possibly go to heaven. On the evangelical side of things, their common practice of proof texting from the Bible eliminates animals from heaven through the citation of John 3:16, the rationale being that the kingdom is only open to those who have been, quote, saved, end quote. From the Eastern religions comes the idea of reincarnation, which is sort of the progress of the soul through time coupled with rebirth. Here, through a variety of lifetimes, the soul learns and grows and moves forward. And karma plays a role here in that the sum effect of one's actions determines the future of one's soul. Also from the East comes a similar idea to reincarnation, transmigration. Proponents of both reincarnation and transmigration are very quick to separate the ideas from each other, although they are both often mistakenly interchanged, one for the other. Transmigration is the reappearance of the soul without regard for growth. Friedrich Nietzsche offered the idea of the eternal recurrence, where time is not necessarily linear, but it's more appropriately described as cyclical. James Joyce's Ulysses, which is commonly referred to as the greatest novel of the 20th century, offers an example of transmigration when the souls of the classic texts migrate into the events of Bloomsday. And the spirit of the Cyclops, for example, from Homer's The Odyssey, becomes reformed in the bar episode when Leo makes everyone think that he bet on Throwaway the racehorse. And in Ulysses, the soul of the text also migrates from perspective to perspective, starting with Stephen, moving to Leopold, and then finally to Molly. Perhaps a better illustration of transmigration is the David Mitchell novel Cloud Atlas. While the movie was a fair representation of the story, it didn't express the transmigration concept as forcefully as the novel did. The book is set up like a literary Matryoshka doll, where we get six nestled stories. And the first story is set in the post-Civil War Pacific. We get half of the tale before the plot shifts to the 1920s in Europe. We get half of that plot before we move to the 1970s and so forth. And this continues until we get the entire sixth story in the middle. And then after that, the remainder of the fifth story follows until we get the resolution to the first story at the end of the book. What's interesting is that because the book is set up this way, the events in the future have an impact on the events from the past. And the character in the story with the star birthmark is the same soul who transmigrates through time, but exists cyclically rather than linearly. Now, the movie jumps around a bit too fast between elements to establish the idea as effectively as the book does. And the book is one of my favorite books of all time. I also like the movie, and if nothing else, Tom Hanks is great in it. But with all these ideas of the afterlife and what happens to a soul when it leaves this plane of existence, I've decided for me on a rationale for my own view of what happened to Smitty when he died and left the veterinarian table there in his last breath. And this isn't rooted in anything scientific, sanctified, ratified, justified, or canonized. It's just my own view of things. It's an opinion. And it's a perspective that has helped me ease the pain of Smitty's passing. First of all, I contend that there are no bad dogs. There are only bad dog owners. And watching seasons and seasons of The Dog Whisperer has confirmed this in me. I also watch Mutton Stuff a lot. But a dog is incapable of making a wrong moral choice, and therefore, I've decided that all dogs must go to heaven. A dog would also therefore be incapable of being subject to karma, because the dog is morally infallible. There are no decisions that a dog can make that are wrong. It does not have the capacity to improve itself. Therefore, a dog dies with no sin nor tarnish on its soul, and therefore, a dog cannot be reincarnated. Transmigration, while literarily interesting, seems a little bit bleak to to be a real spiritual reality. Besides, the Labrador Retriever only goes back 100 years or so, and their ancestry is found in the Newfoundland Hound, and transmigration seems kind of hellish, if you ask me. So the idea of being trapped throughout time and making the same mistakes over and over again doesn't seem like a nice thing for Smitty to be trapped in, so I have eschewed that idea. But to borrow some from the Rainbow Bridge metaphor, I believe that when a dog dies, he is restored to his body and his prime health. If he had some sort of congenital defect or was ill-formed, he has a fully functional system in spite of this. He is happy, playful, has plenty of food and water, and has an abundant companionship with other dogs, and resources are infinite, so there is no fighting for resources. In Smitty's case, I've come to believe that he is now restored to how he was in his prime, say, around 4 years old, and he has use of both eyes. He has no brain tumor. He has no external otitis. He has no swollen glands, and he is a happy dog playing in a field, swimming, sleeping in the sun when it is cool, and napping in the shade when it is hot. I also think dog heaven is tailored to the personality of the specific dog. Heaven is an infinite place, so there are infinite possibilities and nuances. Whatever activities Smitty liked to do on Earth, he has access to in dog heaven. Smitty liked to steal socks from our hamper. Therefore, in dog heaven, there is ample opportunity for sock thievery, and the socks are super stinky. I should note that, yes, there are no bad dogs, and Smitty's penchant for stealing socks is a function of my own malfeasance. I didn't teach him properly. Smitty loved to swim. There are infinite lakes, and he never tires as he strokes through and retrieves an infinite number of tennis balls. There is a room with 1,000 dishwashers that are almost loaded full of that night's dinner dishes. They are caked with pasta sauce and bacon grease. Smitty can lick the dirty plates all he wants, and no one will stop him. When he barks, it is not out of fear, but it is out of playfulness. He gets along with all the dogs. Everyone is the alpha dog, so no one is. At the end of the Rainbow Bridge story, the owner is reunited with his lost pet. Will I join Smitty someday? I don't know. I'd like to. But I guess that's more of a question for the people that I've left behind to decide. Having been a professional musician for most of my life, although I experience a lot of live music, when I do, it's usually tied to some show I'm participating in. I enjoy the bands that open for me and that I open for, but in some ways I'm a captive audience. But about once a year, I get a chance to go to a show of my choice with no strings of personal gain attached. And this past Friday, May 13th, I had the opportunity to see Def Leppard with special guests REO Speedwagon and Tesla at the Greensboro Coliseum. The week prior had been chock full of activity. On Monday, we had a Mother's Day bonus day activity. We kept the kids out of school for the morning, and we went to a strawberry patch to pick strawberries. It was quite fun. And during the week, I got a chance to review some black letter concepts from criminal law, particularly inchoate crimes. I think I'm saying that right. I never pronounce it right. Conspiracy and the Pinkerton brothers was a particularly interesting topic. I also got a chance to see Captain America: Civil War, which was quite good. And I admit I wanted to blindly be stubborn and contrarian by being quick to point out some of the film's flaws, but I couldn't find any. It was a great movie. And then on Thursday and Friday, I co-wrote some songs with an artist from California, and we spent a good bit of time on Thursday and Friday just writing and being creative. And on Friday, as soon as the session ended, not 5 minutes after my writing partner left, my brother Joe picked me up, and we headed to the Coliseum. The Greensboro Coliseum is fairly well laid out, and it's easy to access. Parking is a bit of an X factor because it's only for certain events that you can pay for parking with a debit card. And between the two of us, Joe and I had about $14 in cash, some of that in coins, but parking was $20. And it turned out that the attendant was had one of those square payment acceptors. So thankfully we were in. As we walked in, we heard Tesla finishing their first song, Rock Me to the Top, and the first thing I noticed was that everything was tuned down, either a whole step or a half step, and on some songs for Tesla, this just changed the impact. Like on Edison's Medicine, it didn't ring as well, but on others, it had a very powerful effect, like on Heaven's Trail, and there were stacks of amps on the stage, and I wouldn't be surprised if they were all live because it was really loud. It was very, very loud. I noticed that Tommy was absent on guitar, but a gentleman named Dave Rude was the new guitar player. He had been around since 2009, I found out, and generally the band sounded great. Frank Hannon's guitar tone stood out as the most impressionable element of the show, but everyone was top-notch. Tesla formed in the early 80s in Sacramento, California. They have a classic rock spine with a hard rock slant. They all play vintage gear, but dueling guitar solos are a part of their sound too. Their most popular album, The Great Radio Controversy, contained the hit song Love Song and was a staple in the Fayetteville metal catalog. If you couldn't play a handful of Tesla songs, you weren't going to jam in our garage. Those were Joe's rules. My brother Joe and I had seen Tesla in the summer of 89 at the Cumberland County Civic Center with opener Badlands and co-headliner Great White. The set list then was three songs longer, but otherwise identical to what we saw. I particularly enjoyed Signs from the five-man acoustical jam album, as well as just the general guitar tones. Modern Day Cowboy was the standout track as the set closer. As Jeff Keith sang of the USA and USSR, I couldn't help but remember how different the 80s were. What would have been icing on the cake was if Tesla had played Song and Emotion, their 1991 tribute to Def Leppard guitarist Steve Clark, who died in 1991. After Tesla, we were all able to hear and speak at a normal volume to each other, at least for a couple minutes. My friend Neil had gotten us great tickets, and he was at the show with his wife and his brother, and I want to say thank you to Neil for the awesome generosity, these great tickets. But after a few minutes, I was sitting by myself as everyone had gotten up to get refreshments, but then Troy, the drummer from Tesla, walked out to the gentleman just two rows in front of me, who was wearing a Tesla shirt, and he visited with him for a while, and then they left and presumably went backstage, but it was cool to actually see him up close. Everyone returned in time for REO Speedwagon to take the stage, and Speedwagon stored their amps offstage, which afforded much more space for a Hammond organ and a baby grand piano beyond the drum riser. Because the amps were offstage, everything seemed a little more balanced and mixed more evenly than Tesla. Tesla sounded more powerful, but Speedwagon sounded more polished. They opened with Riding the Storm Out and played hit after hit after hit with no flaws, no pauses in momentum, and really no chance for the crowd to get bored. They played a song called Golden Country, which, although is considered essential Speedwagon, it seemed to be the only time during the set where the crowd collectively sat down. Dave Amato, the guitar player, had some of the nicest and rarest guitars I've ever seen, including a double-neck Telecaster. Kevin Cronin, the lead singer, announced that Speedwagon had played Greensboro for the past 39 years. With nearly four decades of polishing their craft, Speedwagon did not disappoint. I Can't Fight This Feeling Anymore was amazing, as was Keep On Rolling and just about everything they played. I had only heard the Greatest Hits tape as a kid back in the 80s, but my personal favorite discovery from that night and from their catalog was bass player Bruce Hall's lead vocal song, Back on the Road Again. That was awesome. And anticipation grew as a giant Def Leppard backdrop appeared in front of the back line after Speedwagon had left the stage. And among the bands from the 80s that are still playing live, Def Leppard is, in my estimation, one of the best still doing it. And the set opened with a song called Let's Go from their new album. I hadn't picked up the new album yet, but I anticipate spending time with it soon. And the song was good. And the last time I saw them in 2012, they opened with Undefeated, which was also a new song at that time. The rest of the set, with the exception of Dangerous from the new album and Rock On, the David Essex cover, was from their four quintessential albums, High and Dry, Pyromania, Hysteria, and Adrenalize, with most of the songs being from Hysteria. The light show and the backdrops were amazing. They didn't have their amps on stage like Speedwagon, but the backdrop at times created these virtual backline amps, and at times it would morph into a wall of televisions or a marquee or some related image that suited the song they were playing, but at times it just showed their amp faces or speaker cabinet faces. It was pretty great. During the David Essex cover, Rock On, there was some unavoidable commotion directly behind me. I heard a woman doing one of those concert-type squeals, but it kind of seemed out of place because most of the people there don't even know who David Essex was. They didn't remember the song, but, you know, they did a great version of it. But I turned around and I saw a young woman, probably in her 30s, looking frantically for her purse. It was clearly what she was doing. She was very upset. And I looked down at the ground and noticed that her billfold had fallen into the row in front of her, which was directly at my feet, and spilling some of its contents out within our row in about a 3-foot span. I spotted her phone first, grabbed it, and turned back to offer it to her and to her boyfriend. She presented a look of simultaneous disbelief and gratitude. Then I offered her purse and what looked like a stick of lipstick that was to the side of her purse. She was happy to see those too. And then I found her garage door opener, which seemed to be the thing she was most grateful to have recovered from her purse spill. And finally, I saw a pack of extra sugar-free gum, which I presented as a final act of kindness. And she said to me over the din of Rock On, "There are still good people in this world." Her boyfriend shook my hand. I gestured, "Think nothing of it," and I replied, "Now you can enjoy the show." The Steve Clark tribute during the song Hysteria was quite moving. The band also played Switch 625 from High and Dry, which is one of the coolest instrumentals of all time. Joe Elliott's voice has gotten better over the years. In the beginning, in the early days of the band, he sounded kind of like a Brian Johnson AC/DC clone. And that makes sense, seeing as how they were both produced by Mutt Lang, but he developed into a solid tenor by the time Hysteria was completed, and now he hits the high notes with a precision and finesse that wasn't present back then. With Def Leppard, the background vocals are much more present live, if that's even possible, from the Mutt Lang layering that made their early records so distinguishable. At the end of the encore, which consisted of Rock of Ages and Photograph, Joe Elliott announced that there will be a next time, meaning that they'll probably come back to North Carolina in the future. In fact, they're coming back in August. But I look forward to seeing them again, although I imagined, given the vitality of REO Speedwagon and that band's age, they could conceivably tour for perhaps a decade or more. But then again, this could be their last tour. Who knows? But I just want to say I'm grateful for yet another opportunity to see one of my favorite bands. Thank you, Def Leppard. The Mike Garrigan Podcast is brought to you by MikeGarrigan.com.